Are you a friendly person? Do you have lots of friends? Do you keep up with them over the years? You remember that old song from your childhood? Make new friends, but keep the old. New ones silver, but the old ones gold. Yeah, it's a nice sentiment, isn't it? But how many of us actually do have friends that stretch back over the years, that extend back to childhood? Think back to your high school years. How many of your friends from that time do you keep in touch with? And I'm not just talking about Facebook friends. I'm talking about real friends that you really spend time with. Well, today we're going to talk about two people, two very important people in our constitutional history who kept up a friendship, a very productive friendship that lasted over 50 years. I'm Stuart Harris, and today it's Jeffy and Jemmy's Big Adventure.
Your weekly Constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
If you're an American history buff, you may well be aware of the very famous correspondence between two of our American revolutionary leaders, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. It's very well documented. I mean, the two guys lived hundreds of miles apart, and so for most of their years of friendship, they corresponded. And it's a fascinating friendship. It had its hot periods, its cold periods, its period of great rivalry, and then finally, a series of letters in both of the protagonist's declining years, which are some of the most important letters in all of American history. But we're not talking about them today. We're talking about a perhaps less documented friendship, because the protagonists in this case actually lived closer to each other and could talk much more frequently face to face. In fact, the two people we're going to talk about today are one you hear about all the time, James Madison, and his big bud, Thomas Jefferson, who lived just down the road at Monticello. Montpelier and Monticello are only, well, today they're maybe hour and a half away by car. Back in the day, maybe a day's ride, maybe an overnight if the weather was bad or the timing was bad. But Thomas Jefferson and James Madison spent a lot of time together. And of course, they also did correspond, especially when Jefferson was away in France and Madison was here getting the Constitution put together and ratified. But it was a remarkable friendship that was remarkably harmonious. In fact, James Madison once said that there hadn't been a single day when the two of them were not on the very best of terms. And it was also singularly productive, because even though Jefferson wasn't at the Constitutional Convention, many, many of his ideas made it in there, and they made it in there through Madison. Now, I just recently had the fantastic experience of doing something with something called the James Madison Foundation in Washington, D.C., actually Alexandria, Virginia. And I'm going to talk about that in a later episode. Today, I'll just mention that I was at the James Madison Foundation, and the fellow who invited me was a good buddy of mine named Jeffrey Morrison, who's a professor at Regent University and also serves as the educational director at the James Madison Foundation. And of course, when Jeffrey and I had the excuse of getting together, we decided we're going to make ourselves some time, not just for dinner and drinks, but for an interview. And it turns out that Jeffrey had lots to tell me, because he's been very busy, as he always is. And recently, he wrote a chapter on this remarkable friendship, and I couldn't wait to sit down and have him tell me all about it.
I'm an associate professor of government at Regent University in Virginia Beach, and I'm the director of academics here at the James Madison Foundation, a federal foundation created by Congress. And as you know, having read for us this year, whose business it is to help to educate educators about the American constitutionalism.
And a fascinating topic that is, but that's not why we're here today. We're here today to talk about your day job, if I may, and your current research project, right? Your current book. So tell us, our book chapter, or what exactly is this most recent thing you've produced?
It's a book chapter, and it is called Madison and Jefferson, A Friendship Which Was for Life. And those are Madison's words describing his nearly 50-year relationship with Thomas Jefferson, a very close personal and professional friendship, partnership that was, in my view, one of the most consequential for the whole of American history. Hard to think of another relationship between two individuals that was more dispositive of the later United States than that friendship. Perhaps the one between Washington and Hamilton would be a close rival.
Mm-hmm. One that comes to mind, but I know immediately what you'll say about it, is the one between Jefferson and Adams, which was tempestuous and well-documented in correspondence, but probably not nearly so important in terms of the future of the nation, was it?
No, because they didn't really work together as much, nearly as much as Madison and Jefferson did. Of course, there was their collaboration, theirs being Jefferson's and Adams', during the Revolutionary period, and they were certainly two of the motive forces behind the Revolution and declaring independence. But as you well know, there was that long period of estrangement mm-hmm. and political difference, whereas Madison and Jefferson worked pretty much shoulder to shoulder politically, at least following the Adams administration.
Right. Well, before we get into the details, then, let's talk about where this chapter is. It's actually in a very prestigious publication. Tell us where this chapter is.
Yeah, I was very gratified to be asked to write in this. It's now published. Volume is called Blackwell's Companion to James Madison and James Monroe, edited by Stuart Liebiger of LaSalle University in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. And the Blackwell series on American history are very fine compilations. Some of them are promised to be sort of the one volume gold standard for a reference material for events and figures in American history. And this one combines the careers of Madison and Monroe.
How is your chapter organized? Is it a chronological treatment, or do you go by the various themes or tasks that they perform together?
It does deal with their friendship and sort of the facts and the chronology of that long and fruitful relationship. And then the second part looks at the sort of ideological core, you might say, or the political, philosophical core that held them together as well. They first met, they had a kind of glancing acquaintance in 1776, but as Madison was later to say, it was in the year 1779, when they were both serving together, that, as Madison put it, an intimacy developed between...
In the House of Burgesses?
Yes. And then Madison was appointed to the council in the Virginia legislature. And so when Jefferson was governor, Madison worked very closely with him in the council, working on the 1001 tasks of post-revolutionary Virginia government.
Small detail, but you didn't correct me, but I think I was incorrect. I said House of Burgesses. After the Revolution, that's when they changed it to the General Assembly, right?
Right, that's correct.
But they were serving in the Virginia legislature together, and that was a pivotal period, because I'm guessing you're going to tell me about the Statute for Religious Freedom in the not-too-distant future. Was that one of their first collaborations?
Well, it was, and as you know, Stuart, being a law professor, Jefferson embarked on a very ambitious rewriting of pretty much the entire Virginia Code. And that particular production, the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, although it had a long gestation period, finally Madison is able to guide it through the legislature and get it adopted in 1786. But really, it kind of lay fallow for a number of years during that, the critical and crisis years of the Revolution.
How does intimacy develop then?
Well, of course, remember, this is a time when everything has to be done manually. And so the production of documents is a very labor-intensive endeavor. And in Virginia politics, this council was I don't say it was modeled on the King's Privy Council, but it was a council that was there to aid the governor, the executive of the state of Virginia, the state after July 5th, 1776, or Commonwealth, more properly. So Madison got a good taste of how state government was run. And Jefferson, I think, was a more of a visionary, kind of idealistic figure in Virginia politics and American politics. And Madison provided some good administrative ballast to Jefferson. And that's one of the interesting things about this, again, nearly 50-year relationship. You see Jefferson coming up with all kinds of novel ideas, let's say, and Madison having to sort of bring Jefferson down to earth from time to time. You know, Jefferson had this scheme for wanting a new constitution, say, every 20 years. his point was that every generation needed to give its not only its tacit consent, but its active consent to the government, to make it legitimate, to keep it in line, indeed, with the principles of the Declaration of Independence. But Madison had to point out to Jefferson that however laudable a scheme like that might be in theory, that babies are not born January 1st, and then an entire generation goes by, and then another raft of people are born. Babies are born every day. And so it would be very difficult to demarcate when one generation ended and another began to lend its active consent to that constitution.
Not to mention the difficulty of going through that process every two decades. It'd be sort of like constant constitutionalism.
It would be, and as you know, Madison says in the Federalist Papers, of which he helped to write many, that one of the tricks here in this new constitutional regime was to create legitimacy for a brand new constitution to replace the veneration that time lends to things. They don't have that luxury after 1787. So Madison's thought was, if you're always revising and changing and overhauling and retooling the constitution, it will be far more difficult to create that sense of veneration that a constitution would have.
It takes time for us to construct pedestals and to put our founders upon them. And he knew, even as he probably realized it would be applied to him and Jefferson, that there's a legitimate function to that. I mean, one can engage in ancestor and founder worship, and that's not a good thing. But on the other hand, veneration to a certain point is something that keeps a nation stable.
Yes. I'm glad you put it that way about pedestals, because in the chapter I quote a line from a realist sculptor, John H.I. Brauer, who lived from 1792 to 1834. And he did very realistic busts of the founders who were then still living. For example, he produced excellent busts of Jefferson and Madison both, and a very fine one of Dolly Madison.
Hmm.
And the aged John Adams, for example. But Brauer's point was, as he put it, quote, "Ideal likenesses ought not to be palmed on a generous public for real ones." So that's one of the things I've tried to do, too, in the chapters, not to give idealistic portraits or sort of word busts of Jefferson and Madison.
Word busts. That's a great phrase.
Give them the real thing, as Brauer said. And another contemporary of those two, John Quincy Adams,
mm-hmm.
John Adams' son, who had a very distinguished diplomatic career before becoming president himself, said of this relationship between Madison and Jefferson. He said that Mr. Madison was the intimate, confidential, and devoted friend of Mr. Jefferson, and the mutual influence of these two mighty minds upon each other is a phenomenon like the invisible and mysterious movements of the magnet in the physical world. So I use that kind of as the point of departure for this little chapter. And it occurred to me, you know, magnets, they certainly attract, and that's how we generally think of them, but they also repel, don't
mm-hmm.
they? And so throughout this 50-year history together, Madison and Jefferson most often were attracted to one another over matters of principle. But sometimes they did kind of push apart on matters of practice, how those principles ought to be instantiated, say, into politics. And that point about the Constitution every 20 years, that would be, for example, mm-hmm. one point of difference.
And Jeff, before we go on, that line of Jefferson's about every 20 years is so often quoted. Did he ever come around to Madison's viewpoint on that? Did he ever recognize that wasn't workable?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I don't recall offhand what Jefferson's reply to Madison's very gentlemanly but nevertheless realistic reply to Jefferson's scheme was. But
we do know that he did not call for conventions every 20 years, so
absolutely.
Maybe that was his reply.
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely, could be.
Okay, well, what happened next? You talked about late 1770s. What was their next moment of collaboration or friendship?
Well, I think I'd like to say one more thing, Stuart, if I could, about this sort of the general character of their relationship.
Sure.
And there really was a core of principles, I think, around which Jefferson and Madison both orbited, if you will. But occasionally they did have some not sharp disagreements, because late in life, when Jefferson was, when Madison was recounting the character of this friendship, he said, this intimacy and this close personal friendship, he says, was never broken for a single moment, which is a remarkable thing, isn't it?
I have not had any friends for 50 mm-hmm. years, but I've had a few for a few decades, and by golly, I can't say that about any of those friendships.
Yes, well, you're a more difficult person, Stuart.
I am much more difficult than James Madison.
Jefferson. Yes.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with my buddy Jeffrey Morrison, who is a professor at Regent University and also the educational director of the James Madison Foundation, all about a remarkable historical friendship here in the United States between James Madison and Thomas Jefferson. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Jeffrey Morrison. So stick around.
Has arrived. Once again, into our studio strides the quiz guy.
Hello, Stuart.
Doug, how the heck are you?
Oh, I just feel like I have run upstairs like Rocky Balboa.
Well, you kind of look like Rocky Balboa. I was going to comment you're not very well dressed today, but that's okay. Nobody can see you. It's radio. Now, hold on. Wait, are you the quiz guy today or are you the Riddler?
We're quizzing today.
Quizzing today. So that's why no green tights. All right. Well, do we have a contestant on the line?
Yes, you do.
Well, who's our contestant?
My name is Irfan from Philadelphia.
From Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love.
Adrian!
Adrian!
That's correct.
We have Doug's feeling like Rocky today. He's feeling pretty pumped up, so I'm afraid he might have a really tough question for you. Doug, what do you got?
All right, here's the question, Irfan. What country has the oldest written national constitution?
What country has the oldest written national constitution? You mean not just some historical document, but you mean one that's still in effect?
Still in effect. And I've got four options.
Four options, okay.
Is it A, Namibia?
Namibia.
B, North Korea? Mm-hmm. C, the United States? Or D, Switzerland?
Ooh. Namibia? North Korea, the United States, or Switzerland, which of them has the oldest written, continuously operating constitution? Irfan, that sounds pretty tough to me. What are you thinking about this, bub?
I'm thinking between either United States or Switzerland.
Well, wait a second. Not Namibia, not North Korea? Why not?
From my own experience, and I don't recall anything from those two countries. But I do think that for United States and also for Switzerland, it's kind of more a tempting answer.
Okay, more tempting. Okay, well, now you've got your temptation down to the Swiss and the Americans. Which you going to pick and why?
I'm thinking about it's the oldest one and currently, because the thing is, I know for sure American is oldest and is currently running, but I'm not sure about Switzerland if it's still currently running or not.
I see.
Because I'm not sure what's going on over there.
Yeah, well, I can't enlighten you on that one. I have no idea about the Swiss Constitution.
Oh, it's kind of hard.
They make very good chocolate.
Very good chocolate.
Very good chocolate,
right.
And they've got very clean cities and big mountains, too. But see, none of that's the least bit. Do you think that's the least bit relevant, Doug?
Maybe not as relevant as the fondue.
The fondue.
As Brigitte Constant once said to me in Geneva, I could eat the fondue every night.
Could eat the fondue every night. See, I've not even been to Geneva, and I can say that. Okay, we've stalled long enough, Irfan. You're going to have to come up with it, my friend.
Okay, I think I would just go with the United States.
He's going to go with the United States. Doug?
Wise choice.
Well done, Irfan.
Now,
well done.
Yeah, without question, Switzerland certainly has an incredibly ancient system, given the way the Roman roads mark their map. Mm-hmm. It's really quite incredible. But it's, you know, you said it in the clarification. It's the longest single document still in effect. Mm-hmm. And the United States wins that, surprisingly, given how young our country is.
Yes, it is. And in fact, it's kind of funny you should mention that, because if I recall correctly, and you can tell me if I'm right on this one, Doug, one of the things that Madison researched when he was up in the second floor library was some of those self-governing, very democratic Swiss cantons, right?
Canton system. That's right.
Right. But those were particular areas, and I don't know that they were ever, you know, memorialized in a single document. I think it was more sort of a generic or an organic growth of that sort of thing, maybe a series of treaties.
That's exactly right. And, you know, it's interesting. The United Kingdom certainly has older governing documents that it uses. We're coming up on the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta.
Next year, yes.
You know, the rule of law. You know, there's a lot of countries that use multiple documents in their governance, mm-hmm. in the UK being one of the dominant ones. Mm-hmm. But it's, in fact, the United States that has the oldest, really what we think of as a constitution.
Right.
We just beat out, by the way, Norway and Belgium. Mm-hmm. They had some early 19th century constitutions that are still in effect. But today, you know, the United States happens to be the Rocky Balboa of constitution making. We survive.
Take that, Norway. Take that, you Belgians. We beat you both. All right. Well, thanks very much, Irfan. We congratulate you. And go ahead and give your shirt size to us. Send it to us at ywc@montpelier.org. And we will make sure and have a YWC t-shirt just for you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so
much. Thank you. And thank you very much, Doug. We appreciate you, as always.
Hey, it's the Constitution. We read it for the articles.
Yeah, you tell them, Rock.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor Jeffrey Morrison of Regent University, who's just recently published a chapter devoted to the remarkable 50-year-long friendship between James Madison and Thomas Jefferson. Before the break, we were commenting on that phenomenon, how very few of us have friendships that last that long, and that's just one aspect of this extraordinary relationship.
That is a remarkable thing, isn't it? I mean, every one of us would be blessed to have a friend of that intimacy, and not to have a significant rupture of that friendship during such a long time, and such a tempestuous time as well, when pressure is enormous on both of these men, you know, during the Revolutionary period, during the two-term presidencies of both of them, and of course Madison succeeds Jefferson. And that's partly because they helped to work together side by side. You asked me to kind of go on in mm-hmm. the chronology. They work as yoke fellows, as it were, to create the first national political party. We often think of Madison in particular as a supremely cerebral founder. We characterize the founders in different ways, and we tend to think of Madison as the brains of the founding. But in fact, he had to work with Jefferson, or felt compelled to work with Jefferson, in creating an opposition party. Because by the end of the Adams presidency, the single-term Adams presidency, Madison and Jefferson, too, had become convinced that this federal government, which was so much Madison's child, Madison we call the father of the Constitution, was not being brought up properly, you might say, and changes needed to be made. And
I'm going to extend that metaphor, because the people often don't realize how big a break there was between Jefferson and Madison on the one side, and Washington and Hamilton on the other. Mm-hmm. But that's really a great metaphor, because if Madison was the father of the country, then he lost custody of that child during the 1790s, during mm-hmm. the two Washington administrations, and certainly during the Adams administration. So we can almost see this as a custody battle between warring parents.
Yes, I like that. And the lawyer in you is coming out.
hey, it's your metaphor.
Right.
It's an excellent way to think about it that people can relate to today. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what the election of 1800, when Jefferson defeated Adams, was all about.
Absolutely. And Jefferson characterized his very narrow victory, by the way. Mm-hmm. We think that the election of 2000 between George W. Bush and Al Gore was the closest in American history. Perhaps not. That election of 1800, it took, 36 ballots, I think, in the House of Representatives, finally, to decide it. and it was an extremely narrow affair. But Jefferson called that, nevertheless, he called that the Revolution of 1800.
Mm-hmm.
Not of 1776, but of 1800. And I think by that he meant a kind of return, revolution in the sense of revolving, a return to the principles of 76. The spirit of 76 has finally been recaptured because it had been, by Jefferson's and Madison's lights, hijacked. There had been a sort of counter-revolution, especially during the Adams presidency, when those hateful alien and sedition and naturalization laws were passed mm-hmm. by the Congress, but they were signed by John Adams. And so by the late 1790s and early 1800s, Jefferson and Madison were convinced that, in your words, the custody had been sort of wrenched away from in an illegitimate way. And that partly accounts for James Madison's seeming flip-flops, you know, or swings. We call people today who change their positions flip-floppers, and Madison had some of that to deal with in his own career. You know that during the late 1780s, he was a principal mover behind the Constitutional Convention. At least major features of what became the Federal Constitution of 1787, and then of the Bill of Rights. But by his lights, things had been kind of hijacked, especially by Hamilton in the Washington, two terms of the Washington administration, and especially in that single term under John Adams, so that this new federal government, which he called a compound republic, had really kind of been moved in a much more almost monarchical direction. And so Madison saw the threats to liberties, which really was, I think, the pole star of his career, liberty. Civil liberty, religious liberty, to a lesser extent, economic liberty. He saw this new federal government actually threatening liberties rather than protecting them as he thought it would do when he helped to create it in the late 1780s. So that, in my view, sort of accounts for this change of party that Madison makes. He goes from being a Federalist to being a Republican, or confusingly to us, a Democrat-Republican. But he helped create this new opposition party with Jefferson.
And just to remind people, the Federalists were the more pro-British, pro-central government, pro-big city faction, led by Hamilton, as you've mentioned. He was sort of the evil genius of the Federalist side. And then on the other side, the Democratic Republicans, or Republicans for short, which has no relationship to the modern Republican Party, no. was the more agrarian, more decentralized, more state control, less about big business, more about agriculture.
Yes, I think that's a reasonably accurate way to portray it. Mm-hmm. Of course, professors always want to overcomplicate everything. But, I think Madison himself, though, might have objected slightly to the use of the word faction to describe their party, because mm-hmm. to Madison, factions are always bad. And he and Jefferson thought, no, we're creating something good here that will kind of right the ship of state or wrest custody of our child here away from a parent who's no longer being a good parent mm-hmm. to it. So, in a way, Madison not only is the father of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, but he's the father, or at least the co-parent anyway, of our first national political party, that Democrat/Republican party. We tend to forget that, too, I think, that even in our very first administration, there were significant differences and debates and splits. And Jefferson, even while he is sitting in Washington's cabinet, is funneling federal dollars to an opposition newspaper editor whom he helped set up in Philadelphia. This is Philip Freneau, who had mm-hmm. been a classmate of Madison's at your alma mater, mm-hmm. at the College of New Jersey at Princeton. So Freneau gets a kind of no-show government job, thanks to Jefferson, as a translator, I think. But it's just a sinecure. He just has this job. But he draws the salary and then uses that money to set up an opposition newspaper. And it's literally, I think, a block or two blocks from Washington's presidential home in Philadelphia. and the actually is sending three copies of his opposition newspaper to Washington a day, which infuriated Washington. Jefferson kind of wryly took note of this in his notes on the cabinet meetings, how angry Washington was about this.
Jefferson could be a little bit on the calculating side.
Well, that's putting it very charitably, mm-hmm. I'd say. Devious might not be too strong.
I don't think it would be too strong at all. But yeah. So could Madison. Madison was part of this.
Yes, he was. But I think one difference is that Madison, at least outwardly, was more respectful. You never see, for example, the kinds of highly critical, caustically critical things about Washington and the administration that Jefferson writes. Madison is much more respectful and tends to defer to Washington's judgment a little bit more than Jefferson.
This reminds me
of he's charitable toward mm-hmm. Washington.
This reminds me of our earlier conversation. It must have been a couple of years ago now when you kindly went through George Washington's library and showed beyond a doubt that he was a far more widely read fellow than many people would have you believe. But I think this is the origin, perhaps, of that myth that Washington was somehow simple-minded or unsophisticated, and it probably began with Jefferson, and it might have simply been his way of trying to understand how someone whom he had heretofore or previously had respected was now so diametrically opposed. I think Jefferson might have genuinely believed that Washington was a doddering old fool who was being manipulated by the much brighter but more evil Hamilton.
Yes, you've used the word twice now to describe Hamilton as evil or an evil genius, and I think that's how Madison and Jefferson mm-hmm. viewed him, certainly Jefferson, and certainly Aaron Burr. Hamilton is seen, at least by the Jeffersonians, as the motive force of this sort of illiberal, overly expansive, unconstitutional regime now, because Hamilton is really our first, what should we say, Stuart?
Monarchist?
No. I'm asking for you as a law professor to give uh-huh. me a term. A loose constructionist, broad constructionist of the Constitution?
I think that's one way of putting it. He was a big government guy. He was. It was all about central government. It was all about centralized power. And
and he's willing to read implied powers out of at least the language of the Constitution, whereas Jefferson and Madison at this time, at any rate, are more what we'd call strict constructionists.
Right.
They want to see strictly delegated powers there. And if they're not there, like a national bank, for example, then they're going to say that, object to it. This is not constitutional. This is unconstitutional. Hamilton would say, no, it is constitutional. It just, you don't see the words National Bank in there, but you've willed the end, namely the government can coin money and do things like this. Well, a natural corollary of that is a bank.
Right.
So,
but as you've already alluded, neither Madison nor Jefferson, nor indeed any of us, is completely consistent in that regard. Mm. So here you have these two foes of big government, Madison and Jefferson, and what did Jefferson do about the Louisiana?
Sure.
Basically doubled the size of the country with a single stroke, and where in the world in the Constitution does it say the president can do that?
Yes, it doesn't, and he had a bad conscience about it. And he went back to the Congress after he'd authorized Monroe to do it. Incidentally, that Democrat-Republican party, it's fantastically successful. That mm-hmm. opposition
oh, gosh,
party,
yes, it was. For like, 40 years they were in control of the White House or something
yes.
ridiculous.
Yes, well, it puts Jefferson in for two terms, then Madison succeeds him for two terms, and then Monroe succeeds Madison for two terms. So there you got
36 years right there.
Six presidential administrations right there, back to back.
Oh, that's 24, excuse me.
24.
Where's my math?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it went beyond that, didn't it? I mean, beyond Monroe, then after that.
Well, Andrew Jackson, I suppose, a little later down the line, is kind of a Jeffersonian.
Kind of in the same. That's generally when people draw the end of that era.
I think Jefferson was a little horrified by Jackson. He kind of saw him as the rabble, you know.
A lot of people are horrified by Jackson, but we get ahead of ourselves.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor Jeffrey Morrison of Regent University, who's also the Educational Director of the James Madison Foundation. And we're talking all about this extraordinary friendship between Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute. And then we'll talk some more with Professor Jeffrey Morrison. Stick around.
Montpelier is the site of many annual events. The annual Montpelier Hunt Races, an autumn steeplechase event, were started by Marion DuPont Scott and her brother William DuPont Jr. in 1934. The races are held the first Saturday in November. Montpelier has one of the few steeplechase tracks in the country that use traditional hedgerows for jumps. The Montpelier Wine Festival showcases distinctive arts and crafts, specialty food vendors, local agricultural products, and Virginia wine from approximately 25 different wineries in the state. The Fall Fiber Festival is held each October and showcases every aspect of textile manufacturing, from the production of wool to the finished product, and the sheepdog trials. Other events include summer programs for children, a barbecue held in the summer, archaeology expeditions, Civil War demonstrations, and a candlelight tour of Montpelier in the evening. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor Geoffrey Morrison all about the remarkable friendship between James Madison and Thomas Jefferson. You know, one of the most remarkable things about it was that those two guys founded a party that has lasted longer than any other, and that immediately after its founding controlled the White House for several decades.
This new party is really fantastically successful, and it's Jefferson and Madison's collaboration that brings that thing into being.
Mm-hmm.
So, just to follow up on something you said, it is difficult often to make one's practice align with one's principles. And we were talking about constitutional interpretation. Jefferson is willing to depart from strict construction when he finds himself in the presidential mansion there. One of the first things he has to do is to fight a war against the Barbary pirates, who he sees as Islamic terrorists. And he needs a navy to do it. He'd been fussing with John Adams, who wanted to build a navy, thinking that that was extra constitutional, we shouldn't do it, it was a bad idea. Well, he needs a navy, and lo and behold, he's got one, and he's mighty glad he's got one. And the same thing with the Louisiana Purchase, which you mentioned. He finds that he, when he sends emissaries to France to negotiate with Napoleon to get him to sell us New Orleans, he just needs New Orleans, that port. Napoleon's not willing to do it, but he'll sell us the whole Louisiana territory for, I think, $15 million, which is more than the federal, the entire annual budget. Well, he needs money. How's he going to borrow that money? Well, he finds he has a national bank.
The very thing that he didn't want.
That he didn't want, right. That he said was unconstitutional, that he fought tooth and nail, and yet he's willing to use it when he needs it. And he's willing to, as you pointed out, to overleap some of his constitutional scruples about strict construction to authorize that purchase. And then to go back to Congress retrospectively and say, well, could you sort of say that it was constitutional even if it might not have been when I did it, or that the people in their wisdom would have done this if they'd had the chance to do it?
I think, Geoffrey, if we think of strict constructionism as a medical condition, the cure is being elected president. Because I think every president gets into office, even those who are the most critical of presidential power beforehand, you could even think of our current president in that regard.
Yes.
Obama was very critical of a lot of things George W. Bush did. I'm not trying to get political on people. I'm simply pointing out he was the candidate. He was critical. He wasn't going to do things that way. And then lo and behold, he gets in and does all sorts of things that people now think are overreach. And I think that's been true ever since we've had presidents. You get in there and you've got this general mandate to go out and faithfully execute the laws and protect the nation and all that. And even with the best of motives, it's just so easy to take more and more and more power.
It is, and I think it bedevils presidents of both parties.
It does.
You're exactly right. The reality is often very different. And I think another thing that comes into play here is that our unusual system of now at any rate primaries requires a certain skill set in campaigning that doesn't always translate real well into governing once that occupant is in what we call the White House now. So but this phenomenon I think has been with us from the very beginning.
Yep. Well, tell me more about Madison and Jefferson. We seem to always use them as a point of departure, and then we talk about all the ills of the world. What about those guys?
Yes. Well, in the second part of the chapter, I try to focus in on what I think is their ideological center, although maybe that's not the best word, their sort of political-philosophical center. And that, if we had to reduce it to one word, I think would be liberty. It's a political philosophy of liberty. That's what brings Jefferson and Madison into politics in the first place. Indeed, in both of their careers, their very first public action had to do with liberty. In 1769, Jefferson put forward proposed legislation that would make legal manumission of slaves. It's a liberty issue with him.
Right.
As we've mentioned before, that Jefferson had trouble making his practice match his principles, and certainly slavery was a huge example of that. But at least that's his first legislative effort to try to legitimize that, make it legal. And by the same token, 7 years later, in 1776, the young James Madison's first action in the Virginia legislature was to declare independence from Great Britain. And then the very first thing he said in that legislature was to propose a change to George Mason's language that had provided for toleration in the proposed Declaration of Rights, Virginia Declaration of Rights. Madison said, no, that's not, even toleration isn't strong enough. We need to use the language of free exercise, that freedom of conscience and freedom of religion should be is a natural free exercise right. So in both of their careers, the very first thing they do publicly is to enter the lists on the side of liberty. And all the way at the end of his career, very nearly to 1836, the year that Madison died, he's the last of the founders. Unless I think you count Aaron Burr.
Nah, we won't count him.
Okay.
No.
They die. I think they die within a couple months of one another.
Mm-hmm.
But Madison is certainly the last of the major founders to die, to pass away. And he looks back on this entire career of his, and he says that it was, in essence, I'll have to paraphrase, but he says, my whole career was in service of the liberty of my country. I think it is a kind of organizing principle of both of their careers and of both of their political philosophies. Again, they differed from time to time over how that philosophy ought to be instantiated. That's a rather awkward word, but how it could be made real, you know, in real world politics. And they did differ from time to time. So, for example, on the question of religious liberty, in which I think both of them are equally, or to which both of them are equally committed. I don't think there is a single individual among the founding generation who was more adamant about religious liberty than James Madison, or rights of conscience, as they sometimes put it. But when he spotted in Jefferson's proposed Virginia Constitution a prohibition of clergy from holding public office, Madison, he pulled him up short on that. He got on Jefferson's case and he said, listen, aren't you violating the very principle that we both hold sacred? Namely, you are mandating a civil penalty for a religious profession.
Mm-hmm.
You're actually violating this very principle. We agree on the principle, Mr. J. We agree on the principle. But I think your practice of it actually undermines that principle. So I think you ought to change that. It wasn't, by the way, it wasn't the only state.
Was it? Did you change it?
Yes.
Good.
But there wasn't any, Virginia wasn't the only state who was contemplating doing that, by the way. Georgia, likewise, had a prohibition in their constitution.
And if you think about it, that really and truly is an expression of religious liberty, the religious liberty of the clergy person.
Yes. And, of course, it would be news to say Father Robert Drynan, who was in the United States House, I believe,
mm-hmm.
for a number
yes,
of years
of course
from Massachusetts. It also yes. taught theology at Boston College, I
sure.
think. And there have been other clergy of various Protestant denominations who've held national office. I think, though, that Madison's, the way that Madison sort of pounces on that thing in Jefferson's proposed Virginia Constitution is very reminiscent of a position that his mentor at Princeton, the Reverend Witherspoon.
Witherspoon, right.
Yes. Because it was, in fact, it was Witherspoon who took the Georgians to task when he read their proposed Constitution, but he did it in a very kind of clever and witty way. We don't tend to think of dour Presbyterian ministers of the 1700s being witty, but Witherspoon had wit. And so he wrote a kind of op-ed piece and placed it in the Georgia paper saying, oh, I understand. Your position is this. You can't be a clergyman in good standing and hold elective office under this new Georgia Constitution. But if the clergyman is defrocked for some immorality, then he'll be eligible to sit in your legislature. That makes a lot of sense.
Oh, my gosh. I hadn't thought of that. That is very witty.
So
tremendous.
It's kind of interesting, isn't it, that right. Both Witherspoon and his mentee, James Madison, come out in the same on the same side of that issue when in their, you know, when they're looking at proposed state constitutions that forbid clergymen from serving. And Witherspoon does a little more wittily, but...
That's Madison, hilarious. Put it in modern terms. So under this rule, Billy Graham could not have been elected president, but Jimmy Swaggart could have been.
That's right. That's exactly right. Somebody who's defrocked, you can...
That's a great example. Thank you, John Witherspoon. Okay. Yeah. Well, what else you got?
I think maybe even more than Jefferson, since we're talking about religious liberty here, Madison saw religious liberty as maybe the key here. Maybe it truly is the first freedom for Madison. Mm-hmm. Although, as you know, it's just kind of a historical accident that the First Amendment ends up being first, which has the freedoms of religion and
speech.
But
it's a
and
nice
assembly.
Accident, isn't it?
Here I did find the language that we were referring to just a moment ago about this Constitution. Madison says, does not the exclusion of ministers of the gospel as such violate a fundamental principle of liberty by punishing a religious profession with the privation of a civil right? So there, again, he's saying, you and I, Tom, we agree on the principle. We don't have a fundamental disagreement about that, but we disagree about how that principle is to be enshrined in our laws and codified. And here, I think Madison shows himself to be, frankly, a little bit more of the practical politician than Jefferson. And maybe it was appropriate, or even to use your word, providential, perhaps, that Jefferson is the one who ends up writing our more aspirational Declaration of Independence, or drafting it at any rate. And Madison, being at least a prime mover behind the federal constitution, a constitution of government, as they put it in those days, creating the actual machinery of government. And those two documents, of course, the Declaration and the Constitution, are the bookends of our fundamental laws, our organic laws, I believe is the lawyerly phrase for it. We have four of those: the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, the Northwest Ordinance, and the Constitution itself. But it's only the first and the fourth of those two bookends, that really are seen to have a kind of continuing life with us. It's a beautiful law. I don't use that word about laws very often, but it really is, and it's remarkably short and brief. And part of its beauty is that brevity. But what did it do? It provided for the orderly, fair, equitable, just inclusion of this vast territory coming in to the young Union on an equal footing with these older established states, the old line state of Maryland or Virginia, the old Dominion, or Massachusetts.
And that was not a given. You remember Governor Morris. At a constitutional convention, he proposed that new states, after the original 13, be brought in on sort of a second-class status, because he really feared giving up power to these rustics from the backwoods. So that was not a given. But again, I'm taking you off in yet another digression. One of these days, you and I are just going to sit down. We're just going to talk about the ordinance of 1787.
That'd be a wonderful conversation.
Northwest. Okay.
Yep. And every time I read it, I'm reminded of Madison's warning in The Federalist, in which he says, paraphrase, that the laws will be of no good to us if they're so voluminous that no one could read them all, or that they're so lengthy that they're incomprehensible.
But that's why we have law school.
And
that's a lawyer's employment security. But we have to finish up with Madison and Hamilton, because I think our time is drawing very close here, and I see you've got one or two other things you want to say.
It is. Well, I think I couldn't do any better than to close with kind of one of the very last exchanges of letters that Jefferson and Madison had. And it was a kind of, almost a kind of poignant request that Jefferson made of Madison when he knew he was dying. And he said, amidst some other reflections back, fond reflections on their half century together, Jefferson extracted a promise from Madison, and he said, take care of me when dead. Now, what does that mean? Obviously, it doesn't mean make sure I'm buried properly or mm-hmm. decently or whatever. He meant take care of my memory. Take care, and I think more than that, take care of the institutions that you and I helped to create. Help take care of that party that you and I founded all those years ago that brought about the revolution of 1800. And in a last act of kind of... what sort of piety would it be, Stuart? It's not filial piety, because that's to your parents. Fraternal piety.
There you are, fraternal piety.
Yeah. Brotherly piety. Madison took over the rectorship of the University of Virginia, mm-hmm. Mr. Jefferson's university. And I think that was a kind of his last duty to his now departed friend. Madison lived on 10 years after Jefferson. Jefferson and Adams both, as you know, died in 1826, 50 years after the Declaration. But Madison lived 10 long years after that, to 1836. And as long as his health permitted, he attended meetings at the University of Virginia, served as its rector. And this was one of the three things that of which Jefferson was most proud in his life, and which he put on that obelisk, mm-hmm. His own gravestone. And that sort of functioned as, I think, the last, as I say, act of friendship, even to a departed friend, one who was gone. So it kind of nicely wraps up this most interesting and dispositive partnership and friendship and intimacy, as Madison put it, that lasted nearly 50 years and was never interrupted, you know. And that's a remarkable thing. Aristotle had said 2,000 plus years earlier that the best form of friendship is between equals. And Madison, Jefferson, there's a little bit of age difference between them, but I think they both early recognized there was a kind of intellectual equality between them. And that's one of the things that made them, I think, such close personal friends and enabled them to work together professionally as they did for so many years. And as I say, hard-pressed to think of another relationship that was more important, at least to the founding of the country, than that one.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Professor Jeffrey Morrison of Regent University and the James Madison Foundation. That was just a great interview, great story. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Nick Rosa and Bob Hoffman. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.